Hello, and welcome to the Film Show on KBOO. I'm SW Conser, and today we're dedicating the program to a conversation with a legendary filmmaking couple. D.A. Pennybaker and Chris Hegedus have been celebrated in the documentary field for such groundbreaking films as Don't Look Back, Monterey Pop, Startup.com, Down from the Mountain, and The War Room. Chris and D.A., also known as Penny, traveled to Portland just recently for a weekend of screenings, and they sat down with me for a conversation about their work, which tends to focus on fascinating characters in politics, music, and culture, including animal rights attorney Stephen Weiss, pastry chef Jackie Pfeiffer, and comedy writer turned U.S. Senator Al Franken. So without further ado, let's go and talk with D.A. Pennybaker and Chris Hegedus. I'm visiting with D.A. Pennybaker and Chris Hegedus. They are in Portland for a screening of their new film, Unlocking the Cage, which chronicles the fight for legal rights for mammals such as chimpanzees and elephants and dolphins. D.A. Pennybaker and Chris Hegedus, thanks for joining us on the film show.
Okay, thank you for being here with us.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So this is the fascinating film, Unlocking the Cage. You follow a group of attorneys who are kind of on the edge of the legal system looking for personhood rights that have already been granted to corporations, but now they're looking to grant them to non-human primates and mammals who have a high level of intellect.
Right, to animals that have been scientifically studied and proven to have very high cognitive capabilities, that have, you know, societies within their own animal cultures, that, you know, some have theory of mind, animals that are like us in many ways. They're autonomous beings and should have the right to be protected.
So how did this movie come about? How did you meet the people that you're making the movie about?
Well, somebody who had worked with us in the past knew about Steve Wise, and when he told us what he was doing, we both were intrigued by the idea of being in a courtroom and filming a judge saying, "Let me think about this." I mean, that would be, in a sense, such a revolutionary legal situation that I couldn't imagine not wanting to film it.
I imagine some, say, 18th century judges that can't imagine how an enslaved person could be more than three-fifths of a human being.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of cases in this country, slaves, Native American, women, children. A lot of humans did not have personhood rights at different points. And, this is a very novel case to extend the idea of a right to be a legal person to an animal. And in this case, Steve decided to argue for four chimpanzees in New York State. And he decided to do it in New York State because it had the type of common law habeas corpus precedent law that was workable for the type of cases he was going to argue. So he found chimpanzees that were in private captivity, that were alone and being held in a small cage for many years. He found a couple chimpanzees that were being used for research at the university, the State University of New York. So in the end, he had three different cases, and the judges really dealt with this in very different ways. And I think that's what's interesting and suspenseful in this film, is to see how the law tries to grapple with the idea of extending this type of right to another being.
Also, I think it's interesting to see, you assume the law is very universal, but in fact, it's not at all. It's different in every state, and even within the New York state, when you hear the judges respond to his plea, you realize that they're not necessarily bound by the same rigorous rules, that they seem to be able to come up with all sorts of restrictive rationales, and you understand how hard it is to get at the law. It's like a kind of a creature that has many different methods of dealing with things, and it was interesting to see how what a climb he had to make to even get it on the board.
It's interesting what you said about different court districts and states, because it's true in this era when the Supreme Court is so divided that you have different laws coming out of different districts and different states that are often contradictory.
Well, and you watch the people that create the laws, the Senate and the House, acting in ways that seem so unfair and so prejudiced that you think, where is the law? Who is the law? And how can it be made to be fair to everyone? It's a real problem, I think.
Yeah, the problem with laws and legislations is that they need to be enacted and they're interpreted, and they don't give a right. And that's what Steve is going for right now, is that type of security and distinction, is that you don't need interpretation about it. They do have the right to not be killed and not be abused.
Well, you two have been celebrated for documentaries such as Down from the Mountain and The War Room, which was nominated for an Oscar, the James Carville, Bill Clinton documentary. And before that, Penny, Don't Look Back and Monterey Pop were, of course, celebrated. It seems like you don't have a preference for either political or cultural subjects, but one constant seems to be that you're always on the cutting edge of what's just about to break into the greater consciousness. And I'm wondering, is that a skill? Is that a radar of yours? Or is it an accident or a little of each?
It's gambling. You know, if you kept winning at blackjack, you'd think you had some wonderful forensic skill that nobody else. But the fact is, it's sort of luck. I don't know. I mean, there have been films that we started and didn't finish.
I mean, you know, I think we do look around us and try to get a sense of, you know, what we feel is different in the world. And I know when I did the film Startup.com, which I started before the first internet boom and bust back in the 90s till 2001, I just felt like something was really happening in the world in terms of the internet, and I didn't know exactly what the story was. I mean, at the time I started, you weren't even allowed to sell things on the internet. They thought that was, you know, not ethically correct to do it, and of course that changed instantly, and the real story was the whole, you know, boom of internet commerce at the time. I think in this regard for our Unlocking the Cage, you know, there was just a growing feeling in the zeitgeist that our relationship to animals was changing. And, you know, there were a lot of elements that led to us being interested in it. And, you know, Food Inc. and a lot of the writing about agriculture and how we're treating animals was becoming a huge interest to people, kind of at the same time as our culture was getting very fascinated by food and food shows and stuff. And at the time we were doing a food show, we did a film called Kings of Pastry that was about a French pastry competition, which couldn't be more different than this film. But in some way, I think being involved in the food world at that time and understanding, you know, people starting to talk about our relationship to animals probably made me interested in kind of looking at what we're doing to animals more, and kind of led me to this film in some ways.
One of the things that's impressed me is that all the direct cinema people seem to have never stopped doing what they do. Albert Maysles was still riding the Amtrak in his last year. Frederick Wiseman just did an hour and a half Q&A when he came to town.
In Queens, yeah. The Queens film that he did, right. No, Fred we're best friends. But sometimes I can't stay awake for all of his. The films are quite long, but I do like his films. I like Fred very much. He's a very good friend.
Penny Baker Hedges Films is justly famous for anticipating the music video, working with musical acts, but not just bringing out their entertainment value, but bringing out their cultural importance. For example, in Don't Look Back, there were the exchanges between Joan Baez and Bob Dylan. Later on in Down from the Mountain, there was the importance of that cultural element in that music. So, you know, definitely there's that crossover between entertainment and politics, and I don't think there was any better example than your film about Al Franken when he was deciding whether to run for the Senate.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that wonderful? Yeah, I love that. Well, that was Chris and Nick did that film, but it was just amazing to see a person who starts out as a kind of party clown and ends up saying, "I'm going to run for the Senate." It just kills me that you could see that in the same film.
I mean, a lot of our films, I'd say most of our films, are about people who are incredibly passionate. And, you know, they're going to take some kind of life risk to pursue a goal. And I think Al Franken had been interested in politics from the beginning, even when he was at Harvard and working for the Lampoon. And, you know, he was always a very political person. But to, you know, to see that he could really offer something by taking the next step from political satire into politics was a really big thing. And to be able to be there and watch him kind of when he made that life decision was an incredible thing. And, you know, I think he's done an incredible job. And I'm very proud of him. And, you know, it was, of course, a totally fun film to do, because when you're around somebody like Al Franken, you know, things are always interesting. They're always funny. And we've been lucky to be around, you know, some of the most amazing comedians of our time. We did a film on Elaine Stritch, and she's another person who has impeccable timing and is, you know, just so entertaining. And then we did a film called Moon Over Broadway, which starred Carol Burnett. And, you know, Carol Burnett is another one of those people who uses humor to, you know, make life better. And I think that's what a lot of these people do.
I think the first project that you came aboard with Penny on was this town hall debate between Germaine Greer and Norman Mailer. And Norman Mailer had sort of been friendly with Penny up until that point.
Yeah, I knew him pretty well.
Yeah, you know, Penny, when I first started working with him, had a whole wall full of films that he shot and had never edited. And, you know, he brought down a film reel and put it on the Steenbeck editing machine of this women's lib debate. And it was with Norman Mailer as moderator. He had just written Prisoner of Sex, which was basically a book about him trying to be a housewife. And, you know, on the panel was Germaine Greer, Jill Johnson, who was a lesbian writer for The Village Voice, Diana Trilling, a very, you know, well-respected literary critic and the head of the National Organization for Women. And in the audience was anybody who was anybody in New York at the time. The word had gotten out that this was the place to be. So the audience was full of, you know, writers, literati, and politicians, and whoever was anyone was there in the audience. And it turned out to be this unbelievable brawl that was an intellectual and otherwise brawl in some ways. It was a quite, I always think of it as the last happening of the 60s. And, you know, a lot of our films are like that. They're the history of our times. And, you know, this film, Town Bloody Hall, is definitely the beginnings of a wider discussion of women's role in society.
You know, we've been privileged to have as guests on the film show amazing direct cinema filmmakers such as Frederick Wiseman and the late Albert Maysles. And we had Gina Lebrecht on, and this was when she was in town to screen How to Smell a Rose, which was this intimate portrait of Les Blank and Richard Leacock.
Yeah.
And Penny, you go back decades with Richard Leacock, this British documentarian. I believe the first film that you worked on together was a document of the trade exhibition in Moscow. It was called...
He didn't work with...
Oh, he didn't?
No,
okay.
I did work with Ricky while I was in Moscow. Al and I went to Moscow together.
That was Albert Maysles. This was when there was a trade group from America and the kitchen sink debate between Khrushchev and Richard Nixon took place.
Yes, but then later, Ricky came over with the New York Philharmonic and did the Shostakovich Eighth or whatever it was, and we helped him film that. And it was during that time that Al and I and Ricky, working with a hand-wound a Cine Special camera, which only shot 100-foot rolls. If we were going to do this kind of film and make it work, we needed a sync sound portable camera, and none existed. So when we came back, that was what we set ourselves to do. And it took us 2 or 3 years with Time Life helping by putting up a lot of the money that we got a camera that in the end it would work for Monterey Pop, where we'd have five different, actually we had seven cameramen on that, but one of them was an Aeroflex, a normal Aeroflex. The rest were the cameras that we had to build ourselves.
Wow. Well, I've heard you say that you don't make documentaries, you make records of moments. And
that's probably true.
And I hope I get this right, that you didn't sort of think of yourself as a filmmaker at first. It sounds like you were a really skilled engineer early in your life, and so was Richard Leacock, and so was
a physics major.
So was Robert Drew from Life magazine. Yeah. So together, you endeavored to make a portable camera that could be shoulder mounted with synchronized sound that would be much more portable than the ones that had been used on tripods. And so when you took that into the 1960 primary, when Hubert Humphrey was going up against Jack Kennedy, you were able to go into meeting rooms that the other members of the press were not able to and get intimate portraits that you almost can't imagine happening today.
Well, what we got, it wasn't just, of course, the Time Life thing was always getting behind the story, getting behind the closed doors. So you saw a world that you didn't normally see. The thing that we were getting was conversations that you normally don't hear. And that was a big jump because nobody had gotten that before. There was very little of that in filmmaking because most of conversations had to be scripted and written out in advance.
I think when this technology was invented, you know, it just changed the world, basically. It gave everybody the ability to go around and tell stories about real life in real time and find a story that was as equally dramatic as a fiction story, but about real people. And, you know, now that's gone to a whole other extreme because everybody can have a camera. When I began making these films, you know, documentaries were pretty much made by white men. I mean, the equipment was very exclusive to get your hands on. And, you know, now that's all changed. People, you know, in all different cultures can tell their own stories. And that's a really unique thing.
Right. We live in the 21st century when our portable devices, our mobile phones have cameras in them. But as was said recently, just because pencils are being sold to the masses doesn't mean everybody can be Shakespeare.
Yeah, well, that's it. We have, at last, we have the movie pencil, and it enables people singly to consider making a film the way they would have 100 years ago of writing a novel. And that's a big step, an incredible step, because I think the films we're making, the kind of films, are a kind of new language, and people are learning it slowly, but in 20 years, I think it'll have an effect that we can't imagine now. People will be using it in ways that will seem now to us extraordinary.
So the category of filmmaking that you're best associated with is direct cinema, which has been around for 50 years or so and was really made possible through the portable equipment that you helped invent. But it's also set apart by not having a sort of voice of God narration. It's really coming in and letting the subjects talk and not overly interpreting. Of course, you're going to interpret things through the editing and through what you shoot. But how do you feel about the documentaries, the films that call themselves documentaries, but are much more shaped by the filmmaker that lean more towards advocacy?
Some are good and persuade you of some possible thing, and some seem a little hypocritical. I don't know. You know, that's the thing. It's like writing. You know, that good writing alone isn't necessarily the truth. And the thing that's so fantastic about the camera, when you think about it, which, and it's only been around for a couple hundred years, really, as a movie camera, is that when you point it at something, it can't lie. And that's an engaging aspect of whatever you do in film, because people want to see you show something that they can count on, that they know is going to be true. And that's kind of what we try to get at when we film people. We don't tell them what to say. if it's taking a long time for them to get at it, you don't say, "Hurry up! We this film's expensive, and we're running out short." You wait for the thing to be true, and also you want people to be persuaded that they were there when it happened, that it wasn't something you contrived later to make it look like it happened. The idea of being present when somebody does something important is an aspect that only film really can do.
I, you know, from the beginning have always been fascinated by the aspect of these type of documentaries because they're like theater and they're storytelling and they follow a lot of the same structure as plays or feature films where they follow a person through their life and they have a dramatic arc in the beginning, middle, and end. And you know, because they're about real life, they give you the feeling that you were there, that you witnessed that moment. And I think if you can give people that same feeling that you had when you witnessed it, that's a very powerful aspect.
The people surprise you sometimes, just being with them, and it isn't that they're unguarded, it's that they take for granted that what you're going to do will benefit them, that it's not just your movie, it's their movie too. And I think we always try to confirm that sense with people so that they're not just helping you make your film, that it really is about what they do, and it shows it in a constructive and a truthful way, not in a way that's just promotional. And I think that kind of works in our favor most of the time, and it kind of leads to a visibility in the world which hasn't always been there.
I always feel that it's a real privilege to be able to go on these journeys with people, and I learn so much from them. You know, I know in filming this last film with Stephen Wise, you know, he's never given up. You know, for the past 30 years, he's had this unstoppable desire to protect animals, and starting at a point in the beginning where when he walked into a court, people would bark at him. And, you know, he just kept on with it. And, you know, that it's gotten to this point, which you'll see in the film, where a judge gives a decision that's really groundbreaking in some ways about what he's trying to do. You know, that he's had the conviction and the passion to stay with something for that long is something that, you know, I really admire. And you know, it happens in a lot of our films. In our film before this, you know, totally different subject, Kings of Pastry, on a French pastry competition, you know, our subject, Jackie Pfeiffer, who you know is hoping to win this incredible Olympic type of distinction in pastry given by the French president, and you know, it was his lifelong dream, and you know, he didn't get it. But he went on with his life in a way that was so admirable to me. And he crested other peaks and did other things. And I don't know, you learn so much from people when you make these films, and I feel just very lucky to have done this.
I've been visiting with D.A. Pennybaker and Chris Hegedus. They're in Portland for a screening of their documentary Unlocking the Cage, a film that chronicles the legal struggle to grant personhood rights to mammals such as chimpanzees, elephants, and dolphins. D.A. Pennybaker and Chris Hegedus, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Film Show on KBOO. I'm S.W. Conser. Now over to Jen and the film events calendar.
Here's a list of film events coming up in the next month. Tonight, Thursday the 28th, the Hollywood Theater will host the final installment of the Mississippi Records Music and Film Series. At 7:30 p.m., they'll screen Science is Fiction, a collection of surrealist works by filmmaker and scientist Jean Penlevé, to be accompanied with live music by the Space Lady. More information at hollywoodtheater.org. The Northwest Film Center continues its top-down rooftop cinema summer screening series every Thursday through August 25th, with outdoor screenings atop the Hotel Deluxe parking garage in downtown Portland. Tonight, the 28th, will feature Spike Lee's film debut, She's Gotta Have It. Doors at 7, live music at 8, film at dusk, details at nwfilm.org. Over the weekend of July 30th and 31st, the Hollywood Theater will present One Flaming Arrow Fest 2016, an Indigenous Intertribal Film Festival. Saturday features evening screenings of a short films program and the feature Hunt for the Wilder People. Sunday afternoon showings feature youth-made films. Details at oneflamingarrow.com. On August 3rd at 7 p.m., the Northwest Film Center will present Abstractions, films by John Behrens. The experimental filmmaker is known for colorful, optically printed films with haunting synth and field-recorded soundscapes, and he will be in attendance to discuss his work. And on August 10th at 7 p.m., the Northwest Film Center presents Chasing the Wild Boar, films by Julia Oldham. Both a scientist and an artist, she creates film and animated works exploring physics, math, and nature, and she will also be in attendance for discussion. More info on either of these Northwest tracking events can be found at nwfilm.org. On August 11th, KABU continues its own series at the Clinton Street Theater with a 7 p.m. screening of A Letter to Momo. It's a feature-length Japanese anime about a young child who goes on a supernatural adventure, kind of like Alice in Wonderland. More info at cstpdx.com. The 48-hour Film Project returns to Portland over the next week. This weekend, filmmaking teams will be competing to write, shoot, and edit a short film in 2 days, and on Wednesday and Thursday, August 3rd and 4th, the Hollywood Theater will present the finished products, over 50 films in 4 unique screenings. A best-of screening to reveal winners is set for August 17th. More info at hollywoodtheater.org. Submissions are open to the 43rd Northwest Filmmakers Festival, presented by the Northwest Film Center. Permanent residents of the Pacific Northwest can submit up to 2 works of any length or genre released since 2014. Submission deadline is August 15th. More info at nwfilm.org. On August 25th and 6th, the Hollywood Theater will host cult filmmaker Penelope Spheres for Word Wars Summer Bummer. It'll feature Dudes on Thursday and Suburbia on Friday, paired with a short films program both nights and with Penelope Spheres in attendance both nights. More info at hollywoodtheater.org. August 27th is the submission deadline for Fresh Film Northwest at the Northwest Film Center, open to youth filmmakers aged 13 through 19 in the Pacific Northwest. Jury-selected entries will be shown at an award ceremony as part of the Northwest Filmmakers Festival and also will be made available online year-round. More info at nwfilm.org. All right, that about wraps it up. Have a great month, everybody.
Thank you, Jen. And thanks to our special guests today, documentary filmmaking couple D.A. Pennybaker and Chris Hegedus. Thanks also to the Oregon Media Production Association for their support and collaboration. And thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. The audio for the show, as well as our extended interviews, will be available later today on our archive page, kboo.fm/thefilmshow. And you can keep up with us on Twitter, at KBOO Film Show. Now stay tuned for an afternoon of music on your homegrown Portland radio station.